Yeah.
Do send it back.
I will.
She's a wonderful person.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I suppose, I mean, in 1988, I didn't have that many questions. I've now got quite a lot.
Have you?
I don't know how much time you have, but as soon as it runs out, just say that's enough.
Yeah.
But what I'm trying to do, and I mean, I'm quite advanced in writing this, is I'm looking initially at the broad struggle in the 1950s between apartheid and multiracialism, essentially. I mean, that's the larger framework.
You mean non-racialism?
Well, it was multiracialism then, wasn't it? I mean, it's non-racialism.
That's right.
You know? Then the role of the party in formulating and maintaining those kind of progressive ideas through the 50s, or in the 40s, and those people in the 50s, because the party was underground. Then particularly the role of journalists in that process, and then Ruth's part in that.
Yeah.
Okay, so first of all, I mean, that's an outline. I'm really asking, does that sound reasonable to you?
Yeah, no, it's fine. Because, I mean, are you recording now?
I am, yeah.
Yeah.
If that's
okay. What I was going to say is that the point you make about the role of journalists, I think it was absolutely seminal, because we had no public platforms. We couldn't operate at any open legal level, and the only way in which we could express our objectives and participate in influencing the course of events is through the various organs that were published from time to time. And the point about it all is that Ruth, I think in each case, played perhaps one of the most important roles, because of, apart from anything, because of her skills. If you look at the, you know, the journals that appeared in the 50s, which provided the only kind of public guidelines in the theoretical sense.
That's right.
To the struggle that was going on, Fighting Talk, the various versions of the Guardian, and pamphlets and leaflets.
Mm.
So, you know, I would say that this played a more important role, perhaps, than any other factor in keeping the spark alive.
Mm. Of opposition to apartheid, to fascism, actually.
That's right.
I mean,
that's
what it was really all about.
Yeah.
But the things I can't get from other people and I can't get from the newspapers are things that I need to just back up something about Ruth, a bit about her background, where her parents were from.
Well, her parents were from, I think one was from Latvia, the other was from Lithuania.
Mm.
I could check on that. I'm not absolutely certain.
Yeah.
I know that I think he was from Latvia.
Julius, yeah, I think he was.
Yeah.
I don't know where Tilly was from. I asked her, but she couldn't remember.
Well, we could find that out. I'm not absolutely certain.
Yeah. And things like significant events in her early years that she might have talked to, you know, formative things that made her a journalist, that made her the person she was, I guess. I mean, in early childhood, at school, I mean, did you know her at school?
No, I didn't. I got to know her when we...
at university?
Not really even at university, because I wasn't at university. I was a worker.
Mm.
In fact... you know, I met her in the early youth movement of the party, the YCL.
Yeah.
And I only met her, you know, I knew her then, but by the time I got to university, she had just completed.
Yeah.
So we didn't have knowledge of one another's activity at university.
Did she ever talk about things? I know nothing about her childhood at all. It's not a major part of the...
Well, I mean, she did talk about her childhood from time to time. You know, Ruth was a skeptic far earlier than most of us about some of the distortions that were becoming apparent even in those times about what was going on in the socialist world.
Yeah.
And she had parents who were... absolutely unconditionally uncritical of all that. And I think it was partly her good sense and partly the natural rebellion of children to the firm views of parents that she, more than anyone else, sort of questioned. It wasn't always easy to do it openly, but she has she developed a skepticism about the kind of unconditional commitment that the whole movement had towards what was going on there.
Yeah, Ronnie developed another kind of skepticism, which took him right out.
Well, in his case, he became anti-political, but that was a sort of also a what do you call it, brother sister relationship,
sibling.
So it was also a sibling thing. You see, the parents were very proud of Ruth because of the role she played, because of their political commitment, which is the most important thing in their lives. And I'm sure that Ronnie felt that there was a degree of discrimination. I don't think there was, actually, but
was he a younger brother?
He was the younger brother, yes.
You know, in the 1930s, when she was at school, there was a lot of fascist anti-Semitism around, coming from the Nationalist Party. I wondered if that ever had any influence on her.
I don't think so at all, because, you know, when it came to sort of, you know, Jewish culture, I think the whole family was far more separated even than I was. I mean, I was brought up in a Jewish tradition. They were not. And I'm not sure whether she had any special experiences. I mean, she never especially talked about it.
Yeah. Which parent was most influential? Tilly? Tilly was a strong lady.
I'm not sure. No, I think Tilly was influential in both a positive and a negative way. I don't know if one should say this, but, you know, there was always tension between them.
I picked that up.
Yeah, because, you know, it's like all parents in Tilly's position, Ruth didn't know how to bring up children and all that kind of thing, you know.
There's a bit of competition there.
Well, yes. In a sort of a way, not political competition, not at all. I mean, from that point of view, they were absolutely proud and taken up with her.
Yeah. Was she involved in politics at school? Do you know?
I don't know. I honestly can't give you that answer.
And university, Joe. I mean, it's a difficult area for me too, because I've talked to a lot of people who knew her afterwards, but not anybody who knew her at university. The only person who knew her there that I've talked to is Ishmael Meir.
Yes.
Was he quite influential in her journalism or politics? Or?
Well, they had a relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it really was destroyed by the Group Areas Act.
Really?
I'm not sure what would have happened, because Ishmael was here on permit. And then when he finished his studies, he was ordered to go back to Natal. So he had no right to be in the Transvaal. And I think there's a question of Ruth having to make a choice as to whether she was going to join him. I had the impression by that time the relationship had waned a bit. I mean, I wasn't involved at all, so I'm being quite objective at that point in time.
Yeah.
So, I think he must have had. I'm not sure what influence, but
But he was a journalist. I mean, he did a lot of writing.
He wasn't a journalist. He was a law student.
Yeah.
He was a capable draftsman. But he wasn't really a journalist. He wasn't. He didn't write much, as far as I know. I know of no special work by Ishmael. Yeah. I mean, he contributed here and there.
Yeah. No, he probably writes a lot now, and therefore colours about then. Yeah. What was Ruth's main sort of political activity? Young Communist League or Progressive Students Alliance? Or?
Well, at university she was apparently, I wasn't there, involved in the student movement.
Yeah.
But I really can't give details about that. But of course, when the Young Communist League was formed, she was a very prominent.
She was secretary of that.
She was part of a group from the university then,
then we were a group of people who were actually workers. And I remember there was enormous worker intellectual conflict between us. I mean, that's...
Between the groups?
It was a little bit of feeling of insecurity on those who didn't have the education, you know, and these smart Aleks who could formulate and speak and so on, and were just too big for their boots kind of thing. So there was a little bit, it wasn't a serious rift of any sort.
Was this within the Young Communist
League? Within the Young Communist League, there was that to a degree.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a group of us who were actual... proletarians, as it were, in quotes. So my life with Ruth started off with quite a degree of political tension based on this nonsense, you know.
Really? How'd you solve that?
Eh?
A lifetime of solving that, yeah.
Well, no, it wasn't a lifetime. I mean, it soon, I joined the army and then as a result of that, managed to evade the requirements of matric and as an ex-serviceman was given exemption to go to university and I entered the same milieu, as it were.
And so after universities, the 1940s, I'm just sort of going by periods, I guess it's easier. What were its major political preoccupations? And she was she was probably a member of the party, wasn't she?
Yeah, yes, she was a member of the party from the middle 40s, because even in the YCL, I think she was a member of the party.
Yeah.
And then, as you know, I think she qualified as a social...
She did a social science degree.
Went
to work for the council.
Worked for a while for the council, writing speeches for various heads of departments. Yeah.
How did she get into that? I mean, that's an unusual...
Well, she had a degree, and I presume there was an advert, and she got a job. I don't think there was anything special about it.
Yeah.
And then when... people were needed to man or to woman the guardian office. She decided to abandon that, and of course it was made possible because her family had means, she didn't. She could live without an income.
Yeah.
Which is what she did for most of her life here in South Africa until I became a barrister.
Mm. Did she not get paid by the Guardian? I mean,
I recall towards the end, the Guardian people were being paid 25 quid a month. So it was just a nominal sum.
But before she joined the Guardian, was she involved in the 46 strike, the court case after that, and passive resistance?
Oh yeah, I mean we were involved, all of us, in in support groups, leaflets, campaigning, in all these events.
Mm.
But I can't sort of recall any special incident. But she was part of it.
Yeah. And how deeply were you, both of you, involved in the CPSA before its dissolution? I mean, key members or was younger members?
Yeah, well, first of all, we were both elected eventually I think I was elected before her, as members of the Johannesburg District Committee of the party. I think this happened in 1946, 47. We were both on the Johannesburg District Committee. We were always at national conferences, elected as delegates, and we played a very active role. We were both members of what was known as the Johannesburg West branch of the party, which included a number of groups at the university. Now, it didn't mean all the people were at the university, but there were university students then, and they were part of the Johannesburg West branch. One of the campaigns I recall all of us being very actively involved in was 1946 food raids. You must have come across
all
that.
Yes, yeah.
We were all raiding shops and all kinds of things.
The sense I get, but it, could be incorrect, is that the party really changed its character between the 1930s and the 1940s. In that it sort of run itself into quite a hard place by the end of the 30s, and that the 40s was a renewal of new people and new ideas.
Oh yes, I mean, you know, the 30s were the sort of climax of the worst excesses of the Stalinist influence, where, you know, you strengthened the party by purging, you know, by getting rid of people.
Yeah.
And by the time we came in, you must remember it was during the period of the sort of broad United Front days,
yes,
in support of the war effort and all kinds of things. So in every respect it influenced the sort of breadth of conception and thinking of all the people who came in, you know.
But by then the Comintern had been disbanded.
It was disbanded in 43.
Yeah. So I get a sense that in fact the party in the 40s was very much forming its own shape rather than, you know, it had looser ties with Moscow rather than what the state was seeming to suggest.
Well, look, we had, you know, in fact, in the 40s we had no ties with Moscow.
Yeah.
Except in the sense that we bowed in the direction of Mecca every time, you know, the sun came up. But we had no ties because nobody went, nobody left the country. There were no physical relationships at all. It's not like the 30s where the Comintern used to send people to tell us what to do.
Yeah.
So that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah. And what is the effect on the party? I mean, sort of an assessment from way off in time. Was it quite creative, that, or was it debilitating?
I think it was the beginning. You mean the 40s?
Yeah.
No, I think it was the beginning of a broadening out in approach. But
yeah,
only a very small beginning, because the influence of the, you know, the baggage from the past was still there in the thinking of a lot of people. You know, and really by the time, but also there's the other aspect to it, that the party attracted very broad elements who, while on the one hand were broad in their thinking, on the other hand, when it came to the push, were not as sort of deeply prepared for the sacrifice as the sort of committed revolutionaries of the early days, and the result, of course, was about when it came to the crunch and we were now faced with illegality in the 50s. I mean, a huge proportion just fell away because they weren't ready for that. They weren't the old kind of Bolsheviks, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
There was the Bolshevik element still there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get a sense that the party, by dissolving and then re-emerging in 52 or 53, really relocated also, because the influence was up in Johannesburg underground.
Well, a number of things sort of changed the character of the party then. And one of the most important was that we found ourselves without any public platform. The result was that the relationship between the party and the broad movement had to find some other expression, you know, the result of it was that, particularly as far as the black comrades were concerned, you know, the only way they could continue participating in political life was by, you know, through the mass organizations, through the ANC and so on and so forth. And I think that really laid the basis. It was the Regime's Act which in a way laid the basis for the sort of alliance which eventually emerged, because whereas before the relationship was sort of between two organizations and relative independence, and although there was duplication of membership, it wasn't as deeply bound up as it eventually became.
Yeah.
And the illegality changed all that.
Yeah. I get a sense that the discussions in the Johannesburg Discussion Club were very formative in redefining the party. Is that right?
You're not thinking of the Cape Town Discussion Club.
Well, I'm thinking Viewpoints and Perspectives was a publication that came out of the Johannesburg Discussion Clubs.
Yeah, well, that I think was from Cape Town. You know, there was a sort of... I don't recall a discussion club in Johannesburg.
Mm.
I don't know if you're thinking of the New Left book clubs. Not the New Left, the Left book clubs.
No, there were discussion clubs in Durban, Cape Town and Joburg. I only know that because I've got some of their publications. And the discussions in there are leading towards a CST as a theory.
Well, I think that was more Cape Town than Joburg, you know. And it was really, if you read the proceedings of the last conference of the party, the report of the Central Committee, you'll see the basis of CST emerging there. But where it initially sort of was triggered off, I can't really... honestly say.
Well, there are various people who claim to have invented it. Eddie Rue, in fact, goes back to him at some stage.
But does it? In what work?
I think there's a quote that I've seen where he says that we need to understand how oppression happens in one country in a colonial situation, except the oppressors are within the country.
Yeah, well, it's quite possible. I liked Eddie Rue very much, by the way.
Mm, yeah,
well, he's a great guy.
Stuff is really nice, he's writing. But CST realigns the party with the nationalist movement. That seems to me its main sort of theoretical direction.
Well, I think it was a combination of a mutual influence, you know. I mean, that's what happened, you know. I think... It was a national movement which had an enormous impact, obviously, on especially after the 50s, on the thinking of the party and the other way about.
Mm.
And exactly, you know, I mean, we were moving in those directions, but basically it was sort of articulated in a structured way in our program in 62 eventually.
Yeah. Now, just to get back to you and Ruth, I mean, what part did you play in the reforming of the underground party?
Well, I'm not sure about the part, you know, a few of us, when the party was dissolved, it was announced that the party was dissolved, refused to accept it.
Mm.
I was one of them, and there were a group of us who decided that we were going to band together and continue to meet as groups in the hope that others would do it and also to stimulate others to do it so that eventually it would be formed. In the meanwhile, we weren't absolutely certain whether the old Central Committee, because none of us were on the Central Committee, had something up its sleeve. You know, at the beginning we thought it may be a ruse in order to avoid the legal implications of continuation. It then became clear that it wasn't at all, that the people were not ready, you know, the snitches and others, to really continue taking any risks at all. So we actually got together, we met other people, and we sort of put our foot down and said, listen, if you chaps don't do something about it, and if we don't all get together to do something about it, we're just going to come out. We're going to say the party lives.
Mm.
And this happened with other groups as well, and eventually, you know, we got together.
Yeah.
What but, quite frankly, at that point, I'm not sure where Ruth was or what her... Maybe she was having kids, I'm not... It was, you know, it was 52.
When was Sean born?
Sean was born in 50, and then Gillian was born in 52, and Robin in 53. So that was a period in which she was sort of involved in giving birth, and she didn't play such a seminal role in that part of it.
Just a quick one: the old Central Committee, were none of the members on the in the new party?
Oh no, there were.
Mm.
I mean, even those who had voted for the dissolution, see, not everybody did it for the same motive.
Mm.
Some did it because they'd had enough. They weren't prepared to take any risks.
Mm.
Others did it because, and I think there's something in this argument, the old party consisted of people who weren't really prepared for this kind of life, and it might have been dangerous, you know, to sort of just go on without a break.
Mm.
So there were different motivations. A hell of a lot of the LP, I mean, Katani, Dadu, they all voted for the dissolution.
Yeah.
And it was only, as we know, Bill Andrews and Michael Harmel on the Central Committee who voted against the dissolution.
Yes.
Everybody else did, they did it for different motives, including Brahm. Brahm did it basically for legalistic motives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just to get back to Ruth's journalism for a moment, how are you doing? How's your time? Are you okay?
I'm all right, carry on.
On the left in the 1950s, how would she have been regarded? As a politician, as an academic, as a journalist?
As a political activist and as a journalist, of course, as a political activist whose main contribution was through journalism.
Yeah,
that's what she.
Was she also involved in political organisations and discussions and debates?
Because she eventually, you know, I'm not sure at exactly what point, but when the first conference was held, which I think was 1953. Then a central committee, an underground central committee, was appointed. She wasn't on that. I was elected to that. But at the following conference, I think it was 55, she was elected to the central committee. And from then on, she was involved in every aspect of underground building and work.
Yeah. But that caused quite a strain. I mean, you people seem to have been doing so much and raising kids, you know.
Well, it obviously, you know, looking back on it, I don't know, I think we were sort of very euphoric about prospects and a bit blind to what would eventually happen.
Mm.
And I think, you know, there was some basis for being a little bit, in quotes, reckless, because, you know, we had a security apparatus which was pretty poor at that point in time.
Mm.
On the other side, and we just got away with murder, as it were.
Yeah. I asked that question because I lived through the 80s with kids, and it nearly wiped us out, arrests and detentions and hiding. I had a sort of deja vu about it when I was reading about the 50s.
that's another side of it. You've seen World Apart, and that sort of, I think, poses the problem pretty well. The effect on the kids, but I'm not sure whether if we had our lives all over again, I'm not sure whether we would have or should have behaved in the same way.
Yeah.
It's not that we should have desisted from what we were doing. I think we just, kept our kids in ignorance, and therefore they were bewildered, isolated from their own society, because it's not like a black kid. In a sense, they suffered more than black kids at some level.
Well, there was this multiple world they were in. I'm sure at school they were in a completely different world.
Yeah, they have no support, you see. I mean, a black kid whose parents get arrested becomes a hero in the school.
Mm.
A white kid whose parents get arrested is a subject of, of derision and so on. Communist scum and so on.
Yeah. Just on Ruth's journalism, how did she regard her writing? Was she anxious about writing? Did she do it easily?
Well, she wrote pretty quickly, you know.
Mm.
She really wrote pretty quickly, and I think in a sense that was sometimes a defect in her writing. She had too much on her plate, and she had a remarkable flow of language, and, I don't know how to put this, but often I felt that she wrote too quickly on many topics. I'm not talking about journalism.
Mm.
I'm talking about the stuff which, you know, goes beyond journalism.
Mm.
But I think her facility for the flow of words often, sort of was an sometimes an impediment to a more finished, worked out sort of
flow of ideas,
conceptual structure, you know.
Was she ever anxious about her writing?
Oh, yes. I mean, Ruth was terribly inhibited about all her talents.
Mm.
She projected confidence and arrogance and all that, but she was the most inhibited, insecure, you know, in the sense of never feeling that, you know, she was really on top of things, that she could do better and all that. You know?
Yeah, one gets a sense she was very shy.
She was very shy, but it manifested itself in the kind of thing that people often resented, and that is sharpness and assertiveness and so on, you know.
Why do you think she was so insecure?
First of all, I don't want to exaggerate the insecurity. She wasn't a completely insecure person. It's just that I think she was a very hard taskmaster with others and with herself. And you know, I don't know if she was ever satisfied with anything that she finally that she did, and she always felt it could be better, and how is it going to be received, and all that kind of thing.
Was Ruth on the drafting committee of the Freedom Charter? Petralia indicated that she was, but I just wondered.
You know, I'm not sure. Mm. I'm not sure whether she might have played a role.
One of the many committees.
Yeah, one of the many committees. I think eventually this is a very complicated process, the drafting of the Freedom Charter.
Mm.
And eventually, I know some of us who were there definitely, but I'm not sure whether she was on the actual formal group which finally sort of presented the draft to the movement based on the things that had come in.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And just to jump a bit, what was it like when you were arrested for the treason trial? You were both arrested at the same time, weren't you?
In the treason trial, we were both. No. Wait a second. Arrested before me, I think. And I was actually then instructed to act together with the others on behalf of the accused, and then I was arrested myself a week later. I'm not absolutely certain.
Yeah, yeah. But on the trial, it's amazing to me, sitting at the distance of time, that it seems that 4 years were spent defining simply two words, communism and treason. It's the most extraordinary trial looked at in that way. Could one say that's...
Well, the trial was really a propaganda exercise, and
which the movement won, really.
Absolutely, hands down. And in fact, although it was intended to disorganize the movement, I mean, you had the spectacle for the first time in South African history of 156 people representing a sort of even proportion of every part of the population being charged with creating hostility between the races. I mean, it's absolute. You know, I mean, that sight, you know, of this group, the only group in South Africa, in one cage.
Yeah.
You know.
But, you know, the failure and the fact that it was all based, it so much was based on language, how words were used, how things were defined.
I think it was a really clumsy, unthought out effort, and you know, once it started, you see, that's what happens with these things. It has a momentum of its own. They couldn't very well sort of get out of it, and they tried in all kinds of directions to back up their case, but it was, I mean, you've read about it.
Yeah,
also,
Could you say that the trial was really between apartheid and non-racialism? I mean, those are the two core themes that seem to run through it.
Well, I think the trial was an attempt. You see, what was really an attempt at a time before they had decided to outlaw the ANC, was an attempt to destroy the ANC through legal means, through judicial processes. You know, and had they succeeded, you know, and had they succeeded in proving that the Freedom Charter amounted to treason, then the advocacy of that policy would have been illegal.
Yeah.
And therefore, it was an attempt which failed miserably, and that it was communism, of course.
Yeah. What effect did the trial have on your sort of private lives?
Well, I mean, it disorganized my practice. It didn't, interfere so much with Ruth's journalistic activities, because the trial itself was part of what we were all doing. You know? Those of them who were journalists.
Just the last few questions, Joe. How's your ear?
No, it's okay.
During the 60s, during 1960, the emergency, Ruth and the children went off to Swaziland.
That's right.
For 6 months. It's a sort of blank area for me. What did she do there? Did she just sit and wait? Were there other exiles or temporary exiles there?
Oh, yes. No. What happened was that they arrested people in stages. And I always assumed, I told her she was going to be arrested first, and she said, no, I was going to be arrested first. And it happened that I was arrested first. And then a decision was taken that it was coming, the rest of the arrests were coming, and all those who could evade the arrest sort of made tracks, most of them, to Swaziland. So there was a rather big community there.
Mm.
I don't know exactly what they did there, but... they were evading the detentions under the emergency.
And the kids were out of school. They were just sort of 6 months in limbo there.
Christ, let me think. I have the feeling that they might have... I'm not so certain, I don't think they did go to school there, no.
Mm. She must have expected to be arrested when she returned, I guess.
No, by the time she returned, the emergency was over.
Mm.
And we were all being released.
Mm.
I mean, when I was released, she had come back to Joburg, but was living somewhere else, because we still thought they might turn the tables.
Mm. So she sort of went into hiding in Joburg?
In Joburg for a short while, yes.
Yeah. And just finally, Joe and Rivonia, what was Ruth's involvement in the events that led up to Rivonia? I mean, she was still on the party...
She was on the party central committee.
So she was very involved in
very involved,
that.
Yeah.
Mm.
But she, by some accident, was not present, like with me, because I'd been sent out of the country.
Yeah.
At the
Did
moment.
You know it was coming? Is that why you left, or was it fortuitous?
No. In my case, I was sent out together with J.B. Marks to carry out a mission and to return within 2 months and stay underground.
Yeah.
And while I was out, Rivonia blew. So,
She wasn't at Rivonia for that meeting, and that was her luck.
Yeah, that was her luck, yeah.
Was she involved in the mobile radio station? Because that's...
No, not at all.
I understood that she was involved with that.
No, she wasn't involved in that.
Pity, it'd be nice that she was involved with the beginning of Radio Freedom.
No, but she wasn't.
Yeah.
She wasn't.
Ruth was... Why was she not put on trial? I mean, is it just... They must have known that she was involved, and
well, they didn't have sufficient evidence, I think, and... at that time, even though they'd already started this 90-day stuff and so on and so forth, they hadn't gone in for the kind of extreme tortures and so on and so forth. So they didn't manage to get as much information as they later got about people.
Do you think it could be because she was white and a woman, as it wouldn't have looked good on a treason trial where they expected the death penalty?
I don't know what motivated them, but I think had they had... so direct evidence, I don't think they would have hesitated.
Yeah. I'm going to ask Victor that, he's now General Victor, and he's in charge of the Siskiyan police.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very tempted to go and ask him.
Well, why not?
I will. When you saw her again, had she changed much after detention? What effect did it have on her?
Well, she, first of all, she was obviously... she had been affected by the detention in the sense that although she hadn't given anything away of any substance as a result of the kind of mental torture they went in for, she did begin to, make a statement at some point.
From her book.
And I think she sort of bore that guilt for a long time, even though
She knew that she hadn't damaged anyone.
Yeah.
But she felt she'd let herself down and you know, so on and so forth.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to put together somebody who comes across in history, really, like her, and then find that she attempted to take too many sleeping pills. It doesn't, the two don't connect at all in my head.
What do you mean?
Well, in her book she indicates that she attempted to suicide, really.
Yeah, because she thought maybe she, well, you know, I mean, she had concluded that, you know, she would never be released.
Yeah.
That they would go on with this, that she may not be strong enough to
resist, yeah.
To resist, and that she could never live with herself if she didn't resist.
And she knew too much.
And she knew too much, yeah, she knew everything.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, well, most things.
Yeah.
Although she wasn't involved at all, by the way, in the military side of things.
Mm.
Not at all.
What was her real role within the underground movement?
Well, you know, we didn't only have military activity. We had districts, we had branches, we had public material, you know. She... the various campaigns, you know, that went on in the 50s, there were committees and structures connected with all that.
Mm.
I can't detail all her involvement.
Yeah. But,
you know, there was massive activity.
So it was a lot of work.
A hell of a lot of work.
It's amazing that it was never known from 53 till Rivonia.
What was never known?
The part that the party was operating underground, known by the authorities. Must have had quite a tight operation.
No, I think they knew. They knew we were there. They must have known we were there. But we didn't actually publicly emerge, you know, till 1960.
Yeah.
We didn't sort of come out openly and say, yeah, we are.
Yeah, yeah. John, this is positively the last question, and it's just a puzzle. When Ruth went to, and others went to the Soviet Union, I mean, her reports were pretty glowing, and that was in 55.
Yeah.
Was she shown Temkin villages, or
was she shown what?
Sort of not shown the Soviet Union in the way, because later, I mean, it's clear that had she seen more, she might have been more critical. But
well,
wasn't.
None of us saw the real Soviet Union, you know.
Mm.
I mean, when you go as officials from one organization to another,
yes,
you're chaperoned around and you see the you know, the cow that's produced more milk than any other cow in the capitalist world and
yeah.
All that kind of thing.
So there was no way of penetrating the gulags
for the
granaries, you know?
No, I mean, you know, we didn't believe they existed in any case. Thought it was all enemy propaganda.
Yeah. What, that's extraordinary for me. I mean, I can understand it because I was in Moscow, and I'm sure I didn't see the beginnings of what the Soviet Union was all about. But it is amazing that so many years passed without that...
Did you suspect the gulag when you were in Moscow?
No, you couldn't see that there was any such thing.
Yeah, well, that's the point, you see.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was all... it all looked as if it was going very well. Yeah.
Was the effect of Khrushchev's denunciation of Stalin quite a shock?
Well, obviously, yeah. I mean, we were all divided on whether this was so or not. A lot of people, even up to 1980, didn't believe it. But I think this was, of course, the crunch point. I mean, both Ruth and I, Ruth perhaps even more than me, you know, felt that we'd been had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And politically, I mean, was she quite flexible politically in terms of her left-wing beliefs?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, she was committed. She was a committed Marxist. I don't think she ever, until towards the end, you know, when we all went to Europe and new strands of Marxism emerged, you know, the new left and so on, which came to influence her far more than most of us.
Yeah.
Euro-communist strand and so on and so forth. But until then, I mean, she, apart from her sort of earlier skepticism about some of the things that were going on in the Soviet Union,
She was a committed Marxist.
Yeah. She wasn't in the party in later years, was she?
No, she died in the party.
Oh, really? I thought she was not in the
Absolutely,
party.
Absolutely, no. She was in the party. She was in a party unit in Maputo, when we had units there.
Yeah.
Right up to the last moment.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to know. So that's, I'm sure, as much as your ear can take on a telephone.
That's okay.
That's been wonderfully helpful.
Okay.
If you like, I can transcribe this and send it to you, and if you've got some more thoughts, you can jot them down.
Okay, it's up to you.
Yeah?
Thanks.
Okay. Well, that's wonderful, Jim. Thank you.
When is this going to see the light of day?
Well, Zed Press want it as a book, but I really have to... I want to finish writing by the end of this year.
Yeah.
I might not, but that's my goal.
Yeah.
But then I want to send it out to various people, including yourself and to Brian and various other people, and say, look, just, you know, is this okay? Check it. Have I got my facts straight?
Yeah. Well, by the way, you know, you must remember that people like Brian and others actually wanted to hurl her out of the party.
Really? Why?
Well, because of her, you know, during the time when we were in I'm not sure whether you can put all this in, but I just want to tell you that, you know, like on many questions when we were already in England and so on, she, for example, participated in this Italian, there was an Italian international organization that sort of had hearings on various breaches of human rights in parts of the world.
Yeah.
I don't remember what it was called, but she lent her. She was a patron of that.
Mm.
And for example, on the issue of Eritrea, which we had a very pro-Soviet point of view, you know, she was out on a limb.
Mm.
And in general, she was regarded as a sort of. You know, as having moved away from the tenets of Marxism by quite a number of people because of a skepticism about the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
So there was actually a strong move from among the hardened Stalinists to drop her from the party. And quite frankly, between you and me, if it hadn't been for my role, not that I intervened, but because of my status and position, she would have been hurled out of the party quite long ago.
Yeah. That's interesting. Well, I mean, it shows a fairly tough, independent mind then.
Yeah.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay.
Okay.
Guy, keep well.
Yeah, you too, especially.
Right.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.